Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Today, we're meeting the new presidents of the big three scientific institutions in Woods Hole. Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, Marine Biological Laboratory, and the Woods Hole Research Center all hired new leaders this year. Joining me now is Phil Duffy, the new president of the Woods Hole Research Center. He's a physicist who served for 3 years in the White House as a senior advisor to the U.S. Global Change Research Program and as a senior policy analyst on science and technology policy before coming to Woods Hole. Phil Duffy, welcome to Living Lab.
Thank you.
Phil, you have a PhD in applied physics. You've published studies on atomic and astrophysics. You actually worked in the weapons research program at Lawrence Livermore National Lab. But in the past 20 years, much of your focus has been on climate change. So what happened? What made that change?
Yeah, my first, well, actually not my first job, my second job out of graduate school actually involved detonating nuclear weapons in the Nevada test site, believe it or not. So what changed? Well, I knew I didn't want to do that for the rest of my life, and I also realized that a nuclear test ban was imminent. And I had an interest in climate science, which actually originated with my mom, of all things. And my mom was an academic climate researcher at Brown University at that time. And I remember when I was in graduate school getting interested, well, just talking to her about the science and getting interested in it, and she studied paleoclimate and ice ages. And so I had been looking for an opportunity to get into that area. And actually, one of the things that's nice about the big, I was at, as you mentioned, a weapons lab, but it's really a multidisciplinary laboratory. And they have...
Yeah, there's a lot that goes on at those national
There's
labs.
A lot that goes on, and they have a very good climate change program. And I managed to get myself into that program. And I worked in that program for, close to 20 years.
In 2003, you founded a collaborative research program at the University of California looking at the societal impacts of climate change. What are societal impacts? How separate are they from things like sea level rise or erosion that we might talk about?
Well, I was always interested in understanding how climate change affects society. And what that means is the term societal impacts refers to looking at questions like how does climate change affect water scarcity? How does it affect species? How does it affect agriculture? How does it affect, in short, the things that we really care about? But the idea was that we had really good capabilities for doing climate simulation, but not so good capabilities in terms of understanding these societal impacts issues that I just described. But the idea was that that expertise resided at the university campuses, and if we could bring these folks together, we could in a powerful way address those issues.
One of the keys to getting at those societal impacts is something technically called downscaling. This is one of your areas of expertise, basically taking this big global picture and trying to look at what that might mean on a local level. That's still one of the hardest things to do. How much progress have we made?
Well, some. And what I was doing at that time is I was running global climate models on what was literally the fastest computers in the world, which Livermore Lab had for doing nuclear weapons simulations. And the idea that was we wanted to be able to do simulations that were detailed enough so that we could address these issues that I described, like water scarcity and agriculture and so on. And I'll say, it was a really fun and challenging period. And we used these computers that were, as big as your house or bigger and consumed as much energy as a small city, And recently I looked, and you can buy a computer that's almost that fast now at the Apple store for $4,000. I think at the time these things cost $100 million,
So we've made progress on the actual computing hardware.
The hardware has always progressed a lot faster than either the computing software or the scientific knowledge.
So we still have a lot of work to do in that area. I mean, how certain are we of the impacts when we start getting to local or regional levels?
Well, there's some things we know and some things we know less well. And a lot of what we know is because we can see things in observations that are happening already. And when we see things in observations that are happening already, and when that's consistent with what the models tell us should be happening, that gives us a level of credibility.
Is extreme weather part of that?
Extreme weather is part of that. And certainly many regions of the world, we see increases in different forms of extreme weather, extreme heat, very commonly, extreme precipitation. Hurricanes are a little tougher because we don't have good long data records for hurricanes. In order to detect trends and changes, you really need records that go over decades. And for things like heat and temperature and for things like precipitation, we have those in a lot of places. Hurricanes less so, because before the satellite era, a lot of hurricanes were simply never detected because they didn't make landfall.
In terms of extreme weather, I think this is one of the hardest messages for journalists to try to convey from scientists to the public and do it accurately. You actually spent a few years at a group called Climate Central where scientists and journalists are really working side by side. What was that experience like?
Well, it was interesting. I learned a lot about public attitudes about climate change and what they are and why they are what they are. And I think all of us were at the beginning of that process pretty naive about that. And one thing I learned is that the public actually understands that climate change is real and understands that humans are causing it a lot more than you might think. There are differences across political parties, but there's a lot of acceptance of those basic realities across all political parties and age groups. The other thing I think I realized at that time is that a lot of the questioning of the science of climate change is really sort of a proxy conversation in the sense that I think what people really are uncomfortable with is not so much the science, but what they're worried, what they fear that the solution will be, fear that the policy remedy will be. And they worried that a policy remedy will inhibit their lifestyle and inhibit their ability to have freedom and be prosperous.
Speaking of policy, you went from Climate Central to the White House Office of Science, Technology, and Policy.
Yep.
The names of the people and the credentials of the people in that office, always amazing. But I mean, it looks like a grown-up scientist sandbox. What's it like to work there?
That's a hard question. I mean, it's an incredible experience. It can be really, really difficult. It can be really, really fun. It can be the best job you ever had. It can be the worst job you ever had, depending on the day. It's extremely demanding. You know, I'm happy to have had the opportunity to work for John Holdren, who by the way, is a former president of Woods Hole Research Center. John is an incredibly smart guy and a member of the Falmouth community who works incredibly hard, and he's also incredibly demanding. And when you work for him, you really got to do your best work. So but it's great to be in the White House and you meet and you're exposed to just an amazing array of issues and people. But at the same time, you know, you have to accept the fact that you're a cog in a machine. You know, it happens to be the most powerful machine in the world. But some folks who come there think that they're going to have more latitude and independence in terms of influencing things than actually turns out to be the case.
What drew you to Woods Hole Research Center?
What drove me to Woods Hole Research Center is, first of all, it's a first-class scientific place. The scientists and the work that we do are just absolutely top quality, and that's really important to me. But the other thing that is very appealing to me about the place is that we try to, and we do have societal relevance. We do involve ourselves in policy processes, and the specific work that we do has real societal relevance. And this goes back to, I've always been interested in doing science problems that have societal relevance, that can help address some of the really important societal challenges. And so, you know, for me, it was tremendously appealing to come to the Woods Hole Research Center, and I love it every day because the work that we do really is on the front lines and is really super relevant.
Well, the Woods Hole Research Center was actually ranked as the number one climate change think tank, has been 2 years in a row now, by the International Center for Climate Governance.
Right.
This is a relatively small staff.
Yeah.
In a historic building here in Woods Hole, what gives it that distinction and that clout?
It's a combination of the two factors I just said. It's, you know, that ranking is based on the quality of research and on our policy influence. And I should say that that ranking is, in the interest of full disclosure, that ranking is sort of a per capita its ranking, meaning that we're ranked number one for our size. I think that there are, in that ranking, they have a separate ranking, I think, which in which other institutions come out higher because they're bigger and have more absolute influence, if you will. But still, we're very proud of the fact that if for our size, we are ranked.
I mean, without quibbling about numbers, whether you're number one, it's an incredibly influential group.
We think that we are, and I'm really proud of the staff for being able to do that 2 years in a row. And I should say, I deserve absolutely no credit for that, since all of that was based on work that was done before I showed up. So it's nice to get that recognition, but it's really the staff that deserves it.
Of course, the staff is doing the work, but leadership is also important. And Woods Hole Research Center has been in a period of transition, really. I mean, two interim directors in 3 years, and now you're coming in. What are some of your goals for the center?
Well, one thing I really want to do is we've talked about our policy influence and our involvement in policy processes, and we are involved in policy processes at all level, meaning international, national level processes to some extent in the U.S., to some extent in other countries. But the policy involvement is one area that I would like to expand, and that is one of my strategic goals for the center is to expand the work that we do in the area of climate policy. I mean, right now we're doing well, but it's frankly, it's a little bit haphazard in the sense that it's our policy involvement is based on personal connections that the scientists might have, that I might have. And we'd like to make that a little more systematic. We're actually looking to try to hire someone to be a policy director, but we don't have funding to do that. We're looking for funding to hire a policy director, and we'd like to do that.
Woods Hole Research Center will have a delegation going to the climate negotiations in Paris this December.
We will.
What are you hoping might come out of those talks?
Well, I got to be honest, I have never been a huge, I shouldn't say I'm not a huge fan of that process. I think it's proven to be a useful process. But I think the original idea with that process is that we were going to get a binding agreement among 195 countries. And as we all know, that hasn't happened.
That has proven extremely difficult.
I don't think it's going to happen. But what's interesting is I've now, and I think a lot of folks have now, come to the opinion that it doesn't need to happen. And one of the things that's so interesting and I think unexpected in the world of climate change is the extent to which the problem is being addressed on what you might call a bottom-up level. That is, individual countries and also subnational groups, cities, states, are making commitments to reduce greenhouse gas emissions without being part of an overall binding international agreement. And I should say that, one of the things that we did last year, the administration did last year, was a joint announcement with China where we together announced pledges for reducing future greenhouse gas emissions.
Right.
And I think that was a tremendously important accomplishment because China and the U.S. are the two biggest emitters, and together our emissions are a little over half of global emissions. And so for the two biggest emitters to make serious commitments, and they're not enough to completely solve the problem of climate change, but they're really serious reductions. That's really powerful. And that, by the way, is also part of the UNFCCC process. There's the part of that process called, the acronym is INDCs, which stands for...
There's a lot of acronyms in this process.
It stands for Intended Nationally Determined Contributions. And that essentially means...
Basically voluntary commitments.
Voluntary commitments, self-determined by each individual nation. But I don't know the exact numbers, but quite a number of countries have made those commitments. And some of them, frankly, in the case of some countries, those commitments are rather unambitious. But in the case of the U.S., for example, in the case of China, those commitments are ambitious.
A lot of the information coming from the basic science community seems to get more and more dire every
year. It does.
And yet, I feel like I've sensed a shift in the general attitude of people like yourself and climate activists who are saying we are seeing maybe a bit of a shift, that we're seeing more voluntary action, we're seeing more bottom-up action. Mm-hmm. What role, then, does a place like Woods Hole Research Center have if we're seeing more of a bottom-up instead of mm-hmm. a top-down movement? What role does a center like yours play in creating those solutions?
Well, for one thing, we're involved in understanding the science, and that's really important. And I'll give you an example. And one of the problems we work on is thawing of Arctic permafrost. And this is a huge... It's a huge global threat, and yet it's not recognized. And the reason it's a huge global threat is that Arctic permafrost contains a tremendous amount of frozen carbon. And by a tremendous amount, I mean something like twice what's in the atmosphere already.
Wow.
Okay. As many folks know, the Arctic is warming twice as fast as the rest of the planet. As that happens, permafrost starts to thaw. And as permafrost starts to thaw, that material that's been frozen for, in some cases, tens of thousands of years starts to decay, and that emits greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide and methane, and that accelerates global warming. And the concern is that this could be a self-reinforcing cycle and an unstoppable cycle. And so we're involved in two aspects of that problem. One is just understanding the science. Is this threat that I've outlined really real, and at what point does it start to happen? At what point does it become unstoppable? Those are really super important. We've had some exposure recently to high-level folks in State Department and the White House, and we seem to have had some success in focusing their attention on this problem. And you may have heard in at the end of August, the president went to Anchorage and gave a speech about climate change, and he mentioned permafrost, and we were thrilled to hear that.
Phil Duffy is the new president of the Woods Hole Research Center. He's a physicist who previously served as a climate advisor in the White House. Congratulations, best of luck, and thank you for coming in.
Well, thank you. It was nice to be here.
That's our show. Until next week, this is Living Lab. You can always find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab is produced by Elsa Partan and Heather Goldstone. Jenny Junker answers the phones. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Major support for Living Lab is provided by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment and by the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet. Additional support is provided by Lee McGraw and the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation.